Welcome into another edition of Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson. Major news from California, and I think pretty much a shocker that a California judge overturned their assisted suicide law there in the Golden State. Here to explain it all is my guest, Dr. David Stevens. He is the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, to help us understand how this possibly could have happened. Who is this judge, and what on earth led him to make such a righteous decision?
Well, Judge Daniel Atolia is a Riverside County Superior Court judge. That's a higher-level judge in the state system. We actually brought suit against the state of California the same day that this came operative, the law became operative in the state, and doing that with the Life Legal Defense Fund, which is a organization that deals with life issues there in California. That was almost 2 years ago, and things, as you know, drag on in the court. You talked about you were surprised. We were very surprised when we got the news that he had actually overturned this. We thought we had good grounds, but as you know, courts in California tend to be very liberal and interpret the law any way they want. We were very surprised that this happened, and the reason being that they're very liberal judges in California, Adam, and so he ruled that this was unconstitutional, and that was one of the motions we brought. The fact that they did this in a special session of the legislature called for another purpose. And according to the state constitution, they have to limit what they deal with. So why the governor called the special session? In this case, they called it to deal with shortfalls in Medicaid funding, Medi-Cal as they call it there, and instead passed this.
So it was overturned on technical grounds. Does that mean it's likely to rear its ugly head once again?
It could. There's going to be an appeal. In fact, the decision may be out very soon on whether the state will appeal, but I'm sure they will. They're going to have a hard time getting the appeal through. I think the next step they'll try after that is to go back to the legislature and try to pass this again. The reason they did it in special session is because they had trouble getting it through the regular session of the legislature, especially some of the Latino legislators from Southern California were very opposed to this, and they couldn't even get it out of the health committee. So they reconstituted the health committee during the special session and just put proponents on it, got it out of committee, and then got it passed at that session. It may be hard to get it through the whole legislature. We'll just have to see.
Even though no doubt those Latino representatives were Democrat, they still opposed it because there still is a semblance of a Christian cultural heritage from within the Latino community.
It's their culture. You don't take people's lives, you know, give them the opportunity to take their own lives when they're terminally ill. And there's this factor that people are just uneasy about this whole thing and where it could go. Physician-assisted suicide is dangerous. And it's dangerous for physicians, it's dangerous for patients, it's dangerous for families, it's dangerous for society. I think some of the legislators saw that very clearly.
Let's take a step back. How long then was the physician-assisted suicide law in place in California total?
About 2 years. We're coming up on the two-year anniversary. It was 2016 when it took effect. And in the first 6 months, which we had the report for, about 111 people died under this new law. 191 got lethal prescriptions. Compared to the size of California, that's not a huge number, but of course every life is precious, and we're very concerned about where this will go in the future, as we've seen in Europe and now Canada, where this has been legalized, and it goes from physician-assisted suicide to euthanasia, where the patient takes the pills to where the doctor gives a lethal injection, because about 20% of the time when patients take a handful of pills, they don't die. They vomit, they wake up, they take too long to die, and so in other countries they said, wow, let's be, you know, compassionate, let's have the doctor there and just give an injection as they would to your dog at, you know, if you're putting your dog to sleep. In fact, in Canada, which just legalized this under Supreme Court ruling of Canada, or a High Court ruling of Canada, 95% of the cases now in the country are lethal injection already.
And yet we use that term compassionate in quotes, don't we?
Well, they corrupt terms. Verbal engineering always precedes social engineering. So instead of calling this physician-assisted suicide, because suicide has a bad connotation, let's call it aid in dying. Let's call it death with dignity. Let's call this compassionate end-of-life care. They use these words to wrap a bad concept up into nice Christmas paper and try to sell it to the American public. And just recently, the American Medical Association's Ethics Committee came out and said, no, we should use the right term. It's clearly physician-assisted suicide, which didn't make Compassion and Choices, the main proponent group, very happy about that.
Very George Orwellian, don't you think, the way they use the verbal engineering?
Absolutely. And I've debated these people in town forums and on the media, and they use all these euphemisms, and that this is true compassion. This is a choice. People should just have it. They'll be more comfortable. It's not dangerous. It's just loving and all these terms. And many of the people involved in this really believe that.
I was intrigued by the discrepancy in numbers between the number of California residents who received the lethal prescriptions, 190, versus the 111 that actually went through with it. Obviously, some people had second thoughts.
Absolutely, and it happens. And the other thing is, it's supposed to be with only 6 months yet to live. That's impossible for doctors to accurately predict. And 40% of terminally ill patients that they think are going to die within 6 months live longer. Studies show that. And what happens is people get the prescription. They're not really ready to take that step and live a 6 months, year, or 2 years after that. In fact, one patient in California lived over 1,000 days, almost 3 years, before they took their lethal prescription. So all these so-called safeguards that they put around it are really just a covering to make people feel better, but they really don't work or have any effect.
Dr. David Stevens, my guest here on Generations Radio. He's the president of the 19,000-member Christian Medical and Dental Association. You can learn more about them at cmda.org, cmda.org. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. And when we come back, we will talk with him about what the safeguards, even in the California law, were. What is the big picture? How many states have adopted some version of this law that was just overturned in California last week? And what does the long-term view look like for America's future? We'll be back.
It's hard to imagine Christian pastors going to jail for their faith. And it's just as hard to imagine Christian businessmen fined $135,000 for not baking a cake in celebration of a homosexual wedding. It's hard to imagine America turning into a communist state that persecutes Christians and rewards the most aberrant. Will Christians just let it happen? Should Christians just let it happen? These are important questions, my friends. This is Kevin Swanson, and I wrote the book on freedom because I wanted to build a case for freedom. A biblical case. A historical case. And let me tell you, the history of freedom is the most inspiring story you'll ever read. Have you heard the story of the Magna Carta, Bannockburn, Leyden, and William the Silent, the American Pilgrims, and the Battle for King's Mountain? How will we fight for freedom in this generation and the next? Well, tell the story first. The story of freedom. Let's leave a legacy for freedom for our children and our grandchildren. Get a copy of the new book, Freedom for Each of Your Children and Grandchildren, at generations.org. That's generations.org.
Welcome back to Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson. My guest is Dr. David Stevens, president of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. You can learn more at their website, cmda.org. We're talking about the fact that a California judge overturned their assisted suicide law that had been on the books for 2 years. 111 people had taken their lives. Dr. Stevens, tell me specifically, what is the prescription that they get, and who is able to get it previous to it having been overturned?
This is some sort of barbiturates, some sort of sedative, pentobarbital. Barbiturates is usually the class of drugs that's used, but it takes a lot of capsules, 100 or more of them, to get a lethal dose, and they actually open the capsules up and put in an applesauce or something else for the patient to take because they can't swallow that many capsules. And people will die in as short as 20 minutes to sometimes they don't die at all and wake up a couple days later and said, wait a minute, I thought I was going to be dead and I'm not, which has happened in some instances. And those patients have never taken the medicine again. It wasn't a very pleasurable experience for them.
So what is the experience like? Are they gagging? Are they suffocating? Are they in pain? I mean, what is it like for them once they've taken these 100 capsules into applesauce?
They may throw them up, and that's been a complication of this. In Holland, about 20% of the time, patients don't die when they use this type of method. Otherwise, they just go to sleep, essentially. It's a strong sedative that is in such high doses it suppresses the desire to breathe, and they just stop breathing, and then their heart stops, and they're dead.
Wow.
That's how it works.
And who is able to get it previous to it having been overturned?
Well, anyone that said that they were terminally ill, the doctor would say that they were terminally ill, they had less than 6 months to live, then they have to have a oral request along with a written request, wait 2 weeks, and have another physician see them and confirm the diagnosis and prognosis of the first physician, and then another oral request, and they write the prescription. They don't have to take it. They can take it home, put it in the medicine cabinet. Of course, that's a concern because other people can get a hold of it, and they can take it whenever they want to. California doesn't require a witness there, so there's no way of knowing whether the patient was depressed or coerced at the time that they took the medication. These so-called safeguards is pretty much what they are in Oregon, Washington, Vermont, the District of Columbia. Most recently, Hawaii approved this. So there's a number of states where it is now allowed, and we, Oregon, clear back into the 1990s. So we have quite a bit of experience looking at this in, on the long term in that state.
What do we know about the 111 Californians who took their lives? How many of them were perhaps not struggling with a terminal illness, but indeed depressed or in some kind of emotional state?
We have no way of knowing that. Studies have shown that terminally ill patients who desire to take their own lives, about 95% of them are depressed. Interestingly enough, in California and other states, the number that actually gets seen by a psychologist or psychiatrist as a consult is less than 5%. Less than 5 out of 100. We know that people often are depressed when they're terminally ill, and doctors don't recognize it because they think, well, they have every reason to feel bad. They're dying. But it can be treated and helped. Why do people do this? It's not because of pain. The other people proposing this say, well, you don't want to, you know, be in terrible pain, hooked up to a respirator, the doctor won't let you die. They paint these pictures that aren't really true. But about 9 out of 10 of them are concerned about losing their autonomy. About the same number are concerned that they'll be not able to engage in activities that make life enjoyable. 8 out of 10 say they fear loss of dignity. About 6 out of 10 say they're fearful of losing control of bodily functions. About 4 out of 10, I'm going to be a burden to my family, my friends, the caregivers. And only 3 out of 10 are concerned that they will have inadequate pain control. Now, you see the pattern here, Adam. Everybody's afraid, and they're wanting autonomy. These tend to be highly controlling people. I'm going to kind of shake my fist in the face of God, and I'll decide when I'm going to die, and I'll die on my own terms. It's not because they're suffering. We can control pain. We can control symptoms. In healthcare, we've got better things to help in that area than we've ever had. In fact, there's a whole specialty called palliative care where you're specialized in this area. But these people are fearful and tend to be socially isolated, want to do this on their own terms.
You said that assisted suicide is not healthcare and it has no role in the healing arts of medicine, dangerous for patients, medicine, and society. Tell me, what does the Hippocratic Oath specifically say, and are the graduates of medical schools in 2018 even agreeing to and affirming the Hippocratic Oath?
Not very often, unfortunately. In fact, I was at one medical school to talk on this topic, and there was a statue in the courtyard of Hippocrates with the Hippocratic Oath, and I'm trying to go in and convince the students that they shouldn't help their patients take their lives. Hippocrates lived over 2,000 years ago, and when he was a physician, doctors both cured and killed. You didn't know what they would do to you. You think you're afraid going to the doctor. You can imagine what it was like then. If somebody paid them more money, they'd knock you off and nobody would be the wiser, because they had this powerful knowledge of how to use, back in those days, herbs. And so Hippocrates and some of his colleagues got together and said, medicine cannot function like this. The foundation of the doctor-patient relationship is trust. So they came up with this oath, and it wasn't something you took at the end of your training. You took it before they would give you the information.
Oh, wow.
And you took it in front of your colleagues and the community, saying, I will only use this for good purposes. I won't take sexual advantage of patients, the Hippocratic Oath says. I'm not going to betray their trust and share what they've told me. And then it says, I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody if asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to that effect. It also said they wouldn't do abortions. And that revolution. Revolutionized medicine, and patients begin to vote with their feet. They wanted this kind of doctor, and that's the reason Western medicine has prospered and was in the lead in Europe and in the United States in healthcare across the world, because of trust. When a doctor can kill you and help you kill yourself, trust is destroyed. And that's one of the great concerns I have as a physician. It's going to happen as this becomes more common. Is that doctor really telling me the truth, or is he just kind of worn out of taking care of me and makes this suggestion? In fact, Adam, I could convince somebody physician-assisted suicide was a good idea just by how I describe the prognosis and the diagnosis. I can give them hope, or I can give them despair just with what I say. This is very powerful. We even give a criminal court judge this kind of power, but we're going to give it to individual doctors, presuming that they're all ideal moral agents all the time. That's not true. I have doctors I'd send my family to. I know a few doctors I wouldn't take my dog to. Jack Kevorkian would be a great example of that when he was alive. But any doctor can do this no matter what their specialty. They can be a pathologist like Jack Kevorkian in California and give you a lethal prescription.
So out of 100 medical schools today, how many are insisting upon the Hippocratic Oath?
Very few. In fact, some schools are letting the fourth-year students make up their own commitment, if you can believe that, with all the wisdom of the ages. Yes. And we looked at this actually back in the early 90s, and it was only about a quarter of the schools that were taking the Hippocratic Oath. I suspect it's much less now.
Do you have a list of those medical schools at your website?
We do not, but there's a number of Christian medical schools where I know they do, and one at Liberty University, Loma Linda there in California, one in North Carolina, one in Louisiana. But I would check it out if you were, you know, had a child or you were planning to go to school to see where they stand on this issue. A lot of medical schools are just saying, in California, for example, major hospital systems and others are participating in this. They don't force their doctors to, but saying, if you'd like to do this, there's actually a website in California that Compassion and Choices, the proponent organization, has, where they'll tell you where to go and find a doctor or a healthcare system that will allow this.
So how many states in America have a version of physician-assisted suicide? California's just overturned.
Hawaii just approved it. Then there's Washington, Oregon, Vermont, the District of Columbia. Montana had a court ruling which Compassion and Choices claims legalized that it didn't. Essentially, they said, well, a doctor, if he was accused of doing physician-assisted suicide, could use as part of his defense that the patient gave him permission to give this lethal prescription, and they took it. That's never been tried in the courts. That's about it. It's mainly on the West Coast. There's a lot of efforts underway, and especially the Northeast, to approve this. Massachusetts is one of the target states. New York is another state. Last year, over 25 states considered this, none of them passed it except Hawaii this spring.
Is George Soros, the billionaire leftist, behind a lot of these 25 states introducing it?
Yes, he's paying the bill that gives large amounts of money to Compassion and Choices, the main proponent organization, which is based in Oregon. And people need to understand, this isn't about giving patients the right to die. This is about giving doctors the right to kill. Suicide is not illegal. you can commit suicide. But what this does is give protections to the healthcare professional, and at the same time, they grab the respect of healthcare to normalize this. In other words, let's wrap this in a white coat. This is something now accepted by society because the healthcare system is involved. When I was debating this in Hawaii at the legislature a number of years ago, the head of the Judiciary Committee, she said, oh, I'm very much for this. And I said, well, if you're going to allow it to be legalized in Hawaii, let's have people wear black coats instead of white coats.
Oh.
And it should be part of the medical profession.
Well put. Let's talk about the biblical reasons why a Christian doctor in particular would oppose any form of these assisted suicide laws. What scriptures can you point to?
Genesis 1:26, human life is sacred because we're made in God's image and we are not like every other animal. I was doing a call-in show on radio and some guy called and said, I treat my dog better than you treat your patients. I'd put my dog down if he was hurting. And I said, well, you make a good point. We're not dogs.
you turn that one around on him.
Yeah, we're made in God's image. Deuteronomy 32:39 says God is alone, is sovereign over life and death. I put to death, I bring to life. David says in Psalm 139:16, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. God decides the time of our death. 1 Corinthians 6:19, people's bodies belong to God, temple of the Holy Spirit, and therefore we shouldn't destroy them. Exodus 20:13 says, thou shalt not kill, and suicide is defined as self-killing. That's the way you define it in the dictionary. And the Bible teaches that human dignity is inherent. It's not based on our capabilities or quality of life. We see this at the beginning of life, now the end of life. I don't have a life worth living. The Bible says no. Your human dignity is inherent because of God giving it to you, and therefore you shouldn't despise it and destroy yourself.
A lot of times the real answer comes when we follow the money about why various changes occur in our culture. It appears to be, at first blush, that the insurance companies have a vested interest in supporting laws like this, because ultimately they will have to pay much less money in end-of-life care. Is that a fair analysis? And how do the doctors themselves get caught up in the insurance pressure toward death?
One thing, we now talk about healthcare providers. You heard that term, I'm sure. That is some verbal engineering. A provider is something that just gives you things on demand. I have a Coke machine here in the hallway that is a provider, instead of saying that we're professionals. And professionals is someone who has professed that I will only use this information for good, and I will take care of you even to my own detriment. I even put my own life in danger. That's what a professional is. So that's one of the things that people just come in and want this, and I'm a provider, and if a patient wants it, I should provide it. And that's a business term, which I really don't like at all. And healthcare cost is a concern, as we talk about how the slippery slope is there. And for society, it's already happened. In fact, at the hearing where the judge gave this ruling in California, Stephanie Packer was there, and her insurance company denied her coverage of life-saving chemotherapy treatment because it was too expensive, but said it would be happy to pay for her aid in dying drugs, which would only cost about $1.20. This is dangerous in our country, where the biggest issue in healthcare, Adam, is what? It costs too much. It's crazy how much it costs. I was a missionary doctor in Africa. I even told patients it would be cheaper to get on a plane and go to Africa to a mission hospital to get the care they need, because stuff will bankrupt you in this country. And then we bring something like physician-assisted suicide in, where it's very cheap and good end-of-life care may cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so this is a great way to save money.
So what does the Christian doctor do in the midst of that? How do you take a stand? I mean, obviously, you are 19,000 members strong at the Christian Medical and Dental Association, CMDA.org, and that affiliation must give each Christian medical professional more encouragement and the positive peer pressure to push back against a culture that is so pro-death. But individually, how does the Christian doctor, who is being pushed in a very unbiblical direction, take a stand?
Well, they can influence their patients, and each one of them see over 5,000 of those a year in their practice. Secondly, they can speak out and use their standing in the community and in our country. In fact, we formed the American Academy of Medical Ethics, and it is a state policy organization fighting this in every state in the country, and they're going and giving testimony. They're mobilizing our members to speak out. We're suing where that has to be done, and signing on to amicus curiae briefs in major court cases. We're mobilizing doctors to speak in their churches about this issue. There's no logical place to draw the line at. And once you say you can do this for terminal disease, what about people who suffer even more with chronic disease? My wife has rheumatoid arthritis. She's going to suffer more than many terminal ill patients do because of her disease. And then how do you deny it to those who can't ask for it because they can't speak any longer? They're comatose. Don't they deserve this because they're suffering? And what about newborn children? Don't they need that if they have disabilities? And what about the psychiatric patient, the Alzheimer's patient? What about people that don't have anything wrong at all, but they're just tired of life? That's the slippery slope. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in Canada. And it will end up happening here where you can't say no to anyone who wants to take their life.
By the way, if you want more information about the American Academy of Medical Ethics, their website is ethicalhealthcare.org. That's ethicalhealthcare.org. Dr. David Stevens, my guest, he's the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, as we discuss the California judge overturning the physician-assisted suicide law in the Golden State that had been in place for 2 years. 111 people took their lives. You cited it briefly in passing about what's happening in Europe. The Netherlands is what comes to my mind. What's happening there? Because you say there is this bright red line that is no longer physician-assisted suicide, but euthanasia. And again, what's the difference between the two? And then involuntary euthanasia. Describe those three categories, if you would.
There's physician-assisted suicide. That's when the doctor gives you a lethal prescription. And then there's euthanasia. It can be voluntary. The patient says, I'd like this, and signs, give me that medicine. It can be non-voluntary. The patient can't consent. They're not able to do that. They're not mentally competent. Or there can be involuntary. The patient doesn't even want it, but the doctor thinks they should have it, and that's happening. In fact, I sent one of my staff over a number of years ago in Holland and interviewed people, and I'll never forget the story. He was talking to this young man. He said, yes, my dad was terminally ill. My sister thought that he should have the doctor come and put him out of his misery. My mother was ambivalent, and we argued. And then I went on a business trip, and while I was gone, she brought the doctor in, and he killed my dad.
Oh.
I'll never talk to her again.
Oh, no.
And then it was terrible. I mean, you just couldn't believe it. And you see the conflict. You know, that's one of the reasons this is dangerous for families, because it's going to cause discord. And then you've got the problem with tired caregivers and greedy relatives that can get someone to do this. There was actually a article in a California paper some years ago about this elder abuse, and it was an 84-year-old woman, and she said, when I started losing my hearing about 3 years ago, it irritated my daughter. She began to question me about financial matters and apparently feels I won't leave much of an estate to her, and she became very rude. Then one evening she said she thought it was okay for older people to commit suicide. So I sit here day after day knowing what I'm expected to do. And this was even before it was legalized in California.
Yeah.
So this is a big issue, and Europe is way down. In fact, just last week in Switzerland, a guy came from Australia, 104 years old, said, I'm tired of living, help me kill myself, and they did it.
To be clear, physician-assisted suicide, you go to a doctor, they give you ultimately pills, 100-plus pills that you put in your applesauce, because you can't possibly ingest that many pills to swallow them with water. But you do that at your own time, in your own home. The difference between that and euthanasia is that the doctor in the euthanasia category is actively the one who is injecting, for example, the medicine that kills the patient through an IV drip in person.
Absolutely. And then there's other things people get confused about. In fact, the other side try to confuse and say, well, this is no different than turning off a respirator or pulling the plug. People need to understand there's a tremendous difference there. In fact, even Supreme Court in their ruling on physician-assisted suicide made this point. When you pull the plug, what you're doing is discontinuing a futile medical intervention that's just prolonging suffering. This patient is brain dead, for example. So we're going to turn off the respirator. There's no hope. But what kills the patient? Does the doctor kill the patient? No. The disease kills the patient. If the patient got up and walked out of the hospital, I'd be delighted. My intent was not to kill this patient. My intent was to not prolong their suffering when there was no hope. And so there's a huge difference in causation in this instance and what you're trying to do. When the doctor gives a lethal prescription or gives a lethal injection, their intent is to make you dead. My own mother-in-law had terrible respiratory disease because of cobalt radiation she had for cancer. At the end of life, looked at me and said, I don't want to go back on a respirator. You have a right to refuse even life-saving health interventions. When she got admitted to the hospital, I went to her and she was still conscious. I said, Mom Thacker, let us put you on the respirator till the family comes, because it's pretty obvious that this is going to be a terminal event. And I know you'd love to have the family here. And she said, okay, we put on a respirator. She actually got a little bit better. We took her off. And then she said, don't put me back on again. She died with us around her. That was our intent to make her dead? No. But it was her right to say the burden of this intervention outweighs the benefit. I'll live a few more hours. I may live another day. But obviously, this is it. In the next 24, 48 hours, I'm going to die no matter what you do. So that is not essentially pulling the plug, but that is not giving a life-saving intervention. Because if you do that as a healthcare professional, that's actually assault of the patient. The patient can decide not to even take life-saving if they have mental capacity. But the other side of the coin is those rare times that happen when you've got somebody in a car accident, their brain's been made to mush, they're still on the respirator, the family and the doctor decide there's no hope, this patient is not going to survive, and even with a respirator, they're never going to regain consciousness, and you can turn off the respirator, which rarely happens, but we do it. But the intent is not to make the patient dead. The intent is to stop a futile medical intervention. It's not making any difference.
Dr. David Stevens has been my guest. He's the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. You can learn more at their website, cmda.org. Don't forget about the American Academy of Medical Ethics, their state public policy arm. Their website, ethicalhealthcare.org. That's ethicalhealthcare.org. I'm Adam McManus. Learn more about me at my website, adammcmanus.net. That's M-C-M-A-N-U-S, adammcmanus.net. Would love to get your feedback about today's show. adam@theworldview.com. That's adam@theworldview.com. Until next time, we're laying down a vision for the next generation.